This is WCNO Palm City, the good news station.
We're talking with Michelle Medlock Adams, and she's a top-selling Christian author, writes a lot of children's books, has 112 books to her credit. What is your website?
It is MichelleMedlockAdams.com, and that's Michelle with two L's, and it's MedlockAdams.com.
And she's a wonderful inspiration. I want to ask you this. Now, I didn't know until this morning, Adele, who has a radio show and a broadcast here with us, she said that she's met you and interviewed you in the past. I didn't know that.
Yes.
And I didn't know that you had been a journalist. And
yes.
So I think in today's world, are there any journalists left? It seems like the code, when I was younger, you know, Walter Cronkite may have been left winger, but he delivered the news objectively, I believe,
yes.
And even the newspapers would say, you know, give the people the information, let them make up their minds.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then we've had these extreme sides, whether it's Fox on the far right or it's mm-hmm. CNN on the far left. So I'd like to ask you this. What defines true journalism? And do you think that this younger generation, somebody might be listening to this because – one good thing about an interview like this is it'll last forever when I put it on my podcast, when Ryan puts it on in the future. And so if somebody's out there listening, young or old, how do we get it back to journalism?
I mean, I wish we had the answer to that because, listen, I love the field of journalism. I was so proud. And when I got my degree from Indiana University from the School of Journalism, I could not have been more proud of that. And it opened up a lot of doors for me because that's a tough school. And this is what I always, as a young journalist, when I started at the police beat, which is basically one step above the obituary writer. you have the worst shifts. I'm telling you, like every Friday night, and I'm listening to the scanner, and you know nobody wants to talk to you because you're interviewing them after a wreck, or you know they've been arrested. I mean, no one wants to see you coming. It was a difficult. It was a great training, but it was a difficult beat, and that's where I started. And I had to do a lot of court cases and things like that before I got to do some more of the fluffy pieces, which I liked better. And I discovered quickly that if both sides were equally mad at me, I had really done a good job because you have to be that transparent and that clear and that objective and that forthcoming with the news. It's so easy to slant a story in some person's favor or the way that you believe. And we're human. We're going to not always get that right. But every story that I have ever written, when I was writing for the newspaper, I worked for the Schurz Corporation. It was called the Bedford Times Mail. And then I did some stringing for AP, for Associated Press. What I would do is I would make sure that I gave everybody an opportunity to respond. So if I had this really heavy hitting quote that was going to completely make this other person look terrible, even though I knew it probably had happened based on all the facts, I never would go to press without giving that person an opportunity to respond. And I would let them say, I'd read the quote of the other person. This is what they've said. How do you respond to that? Because if not, I'm going to have to go with you didn't comment. I want to give you opportunity to like tell your side.
Yeah.
And I rarely had anybody not to give me a quote. When I let them know, look, I'm not trying to bury you with this. I want to hear your side too. There are always two sides to a coin. Tell me what you're saying. And I had great favor with my sources. And even today, the ones that are still around, I still see them and they still like me. We're still friends because I played it fair. I don't know that there's a lot of that going on these days. There are still some good people out there, but I'm not sure that this is being taught in the schools anymore. And they call it media now, the media school, not school of journalism, but that's how we used to do it. And I think that's how it should still be done. They should not know how you feel about it. Not one bit when you're writing it, it should come across exactly what you said, Rhett. You should present the facts and let the reader make the decision.
You're amazing. The way your brain works is you're like a rock star writer to me. I mean this in all sincerity. And you can carry that badge. And I'll even give you a quote. You can repeat it. But I love what you said. You don't want to bear. You know, I often wonder. A lot of people will come up to me and say, wow, I told you things that I never tell anybody. And it was with the mic on. And so over the years, I've wondered why. Well, because like you, when I meet with somebody, I don't care if you've just killed 10 people. I'm not here to bury you. I'm not here to judge you. Jesus didn't save me to judge others, but to love others. I wonder, why did you do that, and how can we get you to a place of repentance, knowing that's wrong, and save your soul? But so that's very important. If people know you don't want to bury them, and they can trust you, Because there's a lot of people in our industry that are doing it just now because it's the popular thing. And I don't know what happened over the past 15 years, but every young person suddenly wanted to become famous without having earned it, like Paris Hilton. If you have money, you can get famous. Well, that's not real fame. It used to be that you did something that was noteworthy, and that's how you got fame. You earned it, you know. And you
agree. Yeah, I agree with that. And I do think that trust thing is so important. And whether I'm doing it even now, when I do a lot of ghostwriting for people who have stories to tell, but they just don't have the time or the skills to tell it. And, you know, the most important thing, I was just teaching one of the gals that works with me, and she's come up under me. Actually, I think she's going to be a better writer than I am. Her name's Megan. She's amazing. And she's got a new ghostwriting gig. And I said, your most important thing I can tell you is you have to earn the trust. Gain that person's trust, and they'll tell you the things you need to in order to be able to create this book that's going to change lives. If they don't fully trust you, the book will always kind of ring not true. It won't be the stuff that people need to hear. And you can't start off asking the really hard questions. You start off asking the questions that'll be easier for them to answer. You know, you don't go in, like my mom used to say, like a bull in a china shop. You have to go in and be respectful and let them share some things that you probably know you're never going to use in the book or in the article. And that's okay. Just getting to know them. And then as God kind of permits and there's this rapport, then you come in with the questions that you really need to know the answer to. And you're exactly right. They'll share things that they'll say, I've never shared with anybody else, but I believe that this is the time to share it. And you're like, well, this is amazing. I mean, that's how you do it. There is a skill to it. But I think, you know, I think the biggest thing is just being nice. Just doing that whole golden rule thing, doing to others as you have them do unto you. I wouldn't want somebody to come in and try to do a gotcha question and then make me look bad without, you know, taking it out of context and all of that. Yeah. That's not how we do one another. That's not how we should.
No. Now, about being a ghostwriter, because I know I was talking to a guy at a think tank up in Tallahassee, and he's written some books for some famous politicians. And so I asked him the same thing I'll ask you. How do you find, let's say I asked you, like I'm a poet. And I don't want, if I hired you to help me clean up my poetry so I could put it in a book, I don't want to lose my voice because maybe some of these poems might outlast my life. I want to, how do you find my voice? How do you find someone's voice and then, you know, execute that?
If you can do that, you'll be in demand as a ghostwriter because it's not something everybody can do. I wasn't even sure I could do it. Let me tell you, when they asked me to be a ghostwriter at this magazine out in Texas, it's called The Believer's Voice of Victory. They hired me to be a feature writer. When I got there, they kind of pulled the rug out from underneath me and said, hey, Michelle, we don't really need you to do the features, which is why I was hired. We need you to do some ghostwriting. And I remember looking at my editor and I just kind of smiled and I was played like I knew what he's talking about, but I had no idea what that even meant. That was never mentioned in journalism school. And he said, you know what that is, right? And I'm like, I mean, I have the Holy Ghost. I mean, I don't know. That's good. We're glad you have that. But no, we want you to write in this other person's voice. So I listened to his explanation. I said, so let me understand this. I've trained my whole career to find my voice. And you're asking me to lose my voice and find somebody else's? He said, that's exactly it. I said, oh, well, piece of cake. No problem. That was not an easy, it was a learning curve. But what I found worked for me was everything that person has ever said, whether it be in written form or on the internet or in presentations, I would listen. And I would listen while I go take my walks and my hikes. And I would listen when I was on the treadmill. I would listen when I got up in the morning. I'd listen when I went to bed. I would read. And I would start to hear a pattern of how they phrase things and the word choices they would make that maybe I wouldn't make, especially if they're real Southern or they're very Northern. There are certain words that they say that I wouldn't say as a Midwestern girl. So I started making notes and I had whole computer files about their preferences and the way they phrase things so that when I would write their book, I would write it in their words, not mine. The best compliment you ever get as a ghostwriter is when somebody says to your client, to the person you're writing for, man, I read that. I felt like I was having coffee with you. Just say, I'm just like you. If they don't say that, I failed as a ghostwriter. And the first couple chapters when you're writing with your client are always a little rough. And I always let my client know, look, it's going to take me a couple chapters to get in the rhythm of your voice, but I am working diligently to get that. And once we get it, we'll go quick. And that's exactly how it always happens. But you have to have the understanding that you tell me when I send it back for edits, the things you would never say or phrase, and then I'll make that correction. I won't do it again.
So it's like and rewriting. I talked to Debbie Macomber, who's a personal friend of mine. She sold about 240 million copies of her romantic books.
I know who that is.
Yeah. And Debbie told me, she says, well, Rhett, she said, I read every book I write. I've read no less than 10 times before it hits the streets. And it also goes through writers and editors, et cetera, et cetera. So I wanted to ask you this. So would you agree that rewriting is the sign of a pro? And after you get to know somebody, perhaps you go back and work on the first two chapters because your knowledge has increased incredibly by that point. Of that person.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't think I've ever had a first draft of a first or second chapter that made it into the book that way. Many times you'll think that's the first chapter and you'll get into it and realize, no, that's the fifth chapter. I've got a better first chapter. And that's just the name of the game. But rewriting, anybody who doesn't rewrite I don't think they're writers. You can't call yourself a writer if you just think, well, what I put down the first moment I wrote it is golden. I wish it happened like that, but that is not typically the course. We have to continue to get better. And it's good to step away from it for a couple of days and come back to it. And then you can see with fresh eyes what doesn't work and what does work and what I need another anecdote here. I need to ask them about this particular thing. It's like putting together this huge puzzle. And at the end, it's just exactly put that last piece in and you want to just do this victory lap. It's the most exciting, satisfying thing ever. And then when I see my clients on the major news broadcast, talking about their book, and I'm so proud of them because it's not my book. It's their book. I just helped them say it in a way that others could receive it.
Well, I'd tell you, I have a selfish reason, too, for having you on because I've written a number of books, but I've never released them because I'm in fear that, I graduated only eighth grade. But I have a friend of mine. He's a billionaire, and he only got an eighth grade education. Matter of fact, he jokes with me sometimes. He's in his 80s. He says, well, Rhett, can you imagine what I could have done if I got a ninth grade education?
but I love that.
But what I do want to say is this, that there's people listening to this who go, oh, I'm not good enough. I wasn't summa cum laude or whatever, and I didn't go to college, or I wasn't on the dean's list, or I didn't even go to college, or I didn't even finish high school. I just want people, no education does not mean you cannot be a successful author, correct?
That is correct. More so now than ever before because of how many venues there and ways there are to get your book out. You absolutely don't have to have that training. And when I started in this business, if you didn't have at least a BA or BS in something kind of writing and communications, it would be hard to get into a newspaper or magazine to be on their staff. But today, most things are done remotely anyway. They're mostly freelance, and they don't care what your education is. They mostly just care if you can write or not, and if you can hit a deadline.
Tune in again tomorrow at 3 a.m., 7 a.m., or 3 p.m. for the continuation of this interview. I'm your host, Rhett Palmer, and this is a new day.
Today's broadcast is supported by Plains Dental Arts in Vero Beach and Port St. Lucie. Thanks to Dr. Alex Plain at Plains Dental Arts for keeping New Day with Rhett Palmer on the air daily at WCNO 89.9 FM.
Coming through the years, saying I will have to choose between faith and fear. Just as Jesus heard it each moment his life through, everyone who trusts in him is sure to hear it too.